prevention is great, but you can't prevent everything. This was just an unforeseen tragedy.
In a rare attack, a polar bear kills a mother and son in Wales. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Alaska House breaks its deadlock and elects a speaker, Republican Kathy Tilton.
I think that we can all agree that a priority of this session is to deal with the fiscal stability of the state of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association mission is to enhance the movement, health, and wellness in the communities where practitioners live and serve. Life's pleasures and richness of experience frequently relate directly to the ability to move without pain or limitation. To promote physical therapy access for all Alaskans, sessions are offered on Saturdays at no charge for those with financial barriers to care. More at aptaalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Physical Therapy Association.
A polar bear killed a 24-year-old woman and her young son yesterday during an extremely rare mauling in the remote western Alaska village of Wales. Alaska state troopers say Summer Myomik and 1-year-old Clyde Onktwazruk died in the attack. Susan Nedza, the superintendent of the Bering Strait School District, says the bear had chased people into the local school Tuesday afternoon.
So when they tried to scare the bear away, it chased them and they went into the school for safety and it tried to come with them. Yeah, they just pulled the door quick enough that it didn't get in.
Troopers say a community member shot and killed the polar bear during the mauling. Communities like Wales are patrolled for polar bears from July through mid-November, but the bears are usually on sea ice at this time of year. Nedza says residents of the region coexist with both its wildlife and its dangers.
Prevention is great, but you can't prevent everything. This was just an unforeseen tragedy.
Wales is located about 100 miles northwest of Nome. Troopers say bad weather and a lack of landing lights in Wales kept them from flying there yesterday. They were still trying to reach the village today. Nedza says the local school was closed today and will reopen after consulting with residents on how and when to do so. Grief counselors are also flying in when weather permits to help the community cope. So there are many unanswered questions about the fatal polar bear attack in Wales yesterday, all pointing to the biggest question of all, why did it happen? As the community grieves the loss of two residents, researchers and officials are delicately trying to learn more. That includes Jeff York, the Senior Director of Conservation at Polar Bears International. York says polar bear attacks are extremely rare. The last fatal mauling in Alaska was more than 3 decades ago, but the big white bears are not an uncommon sight in Wales.
First reaction was absolute sadness. I've been to Wales. I've worked with people in Wales. It's a fantastic community, a strong community. And yeah, my heart goes out to all those involved and friends and family across the region, I'm sure, who are still trying to, you know, understand what happened. Like you said, these attacks in Alaska are thankfully very rare, and they're even more rare in January, that far north. That region right now has a lot of sea ice, and polar bears should be out on that ice hunting seals.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit more, because it seems like in past years where there hasn't been as much sea ice, and we've talked about that as the climate continues to warm year after year, that the problem for polar bears is that they need that sea ice as a platform to hunt from, right?
Right. Polar bears have evolved as what we'd call an obligate predator. They hunt other animals for the sole source of all of their calories, and they've specifically evolved for a high-fat marine mammal diet that's almost impossible to replace outside that marine environment. Those calories just don't exist on shore, especially in the Arctic. And so they're very highly refined for a very specific type of prey and a very specific source of energy that keeps them going through those long winters.
So I guess given all that and with the understanding that this just happened on Tuesday, what do you make of all that? I mean, why would this have happened?
We just don't know right now. Details are still coming out. Key partners like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, key partners with the state of Alaska, haven't been able to get into town. They're also being very respectful that that community is grieving and still reeling from the actual events that happened there. So we just don't know all of those details yet.
Gotcha. Yeah. What kind of things would folks heading into there trying to figure out what happened, what would they be looking at?
The team going in will look at a number of things. They'll definitely try to get their hands on the bear itself and see if there's any, you know, clear indications of the bear being in poor body condition. They'll look at the age of the bear, the health of the bear, if they can, the sex of the bear, and then they'll talk to local community members about events leading up to and during the event itself and just try to get as much information as possible. It's difficult to do in these times as people are traumatized, you know, by what happened, but it's also critically important that we get as much information from these events as possible so we can, you know, share lessons learned and share information with other communities going forward. The end goal is to, you know, try to keep people safe.
Yeah. If the sea ice is doing well right now in that area, are there reasons why polar bears might still be very hungry or might be even starving, even with that?
I think that's an interesting question, and it may well become the crux of questions asked in coming months. And I think it's important too to separate kind of two things. On the one hand, historically, so even going back beyond written records, polar bears have attacked and killed people, potentially for food, regardless of sea ice conditions. So linking one event to this larger environmental phenomenon that's ongoing today is always a bit risky. That being said, we know that the Chukchi Sea has experienced dramatic changes in sea ice, both sea ice extent, sea ice volume, and then how sea ice behaves during the course of the year, becoming much more dynamic, even during the winter. What we don't know is what's fully happening down the ecosystem, what changes are occurring underneath the ice, and how are those changes kind of communicating back to a species like polar bears that live on top of the ice and make their living from all of that productivity. As that entire region changes, as that lid of ice that's historically been in place for much longer periods of time and has been much more stable over those periods of time changes, you know, as to what comes next, there are a lot of questions, and change has already happened in some cases if we're seeing it manifest itself in polar bears.
That was Polar Bears International Senior Director of Conservation, Jeff York. After a chaotic start to the session, the Alaska House elected Wasilla Representative Kathy Tilton to the role of House Speaker today. Tilton's new role marks the beginning of the organization process for a divided House that has struggled to form a majority coalition ahead of the session start.
I want to let every member of the House know that it is my intent to treat every member fairly in this body and to bring the respect and decorum to this House that it deserves, to bring the public's respect to this House.
Tilton says lawmakers did not want a repeat of the last two legislative cycles in which it took the body weeks to organize. According to Tilton, the majority coalition currently includes every House Republican except Wasilla Representative David Eastman and Kodiak Representative Louise Stutes. Tilton says it also includes the four-member Bush Caucus, made up of Western and Northern Alaska representatives. Tilton says the coalition is one based on policy agreement.
I think that we can all agree that a priority of this session is to deal with the fiscal stability of the state of Alaska. That is probably the number one issue that we'll be working on.
Anchorage Democrat Zach Fields, now in the minority, says the majority coalition is geographically and politically very diverse, but he hopes that won't stop them from working together. Fields says most of his colleagues support priorities the Senate has already laid out, including increasing education funding and restoring a defined benefits pension plan for state employees.
Our imperative going forward is for the majority and minority to work together on those shared goals, because those are the two most important issues facing us this year.
Tilton said the House will start announcing committee assignments tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, as Fairbanks gets ready to demolish a condemned hotel, developers are already thinking about what's next.
You know, if you want a great place to work, eat, live, learn, and play for the rest of your life, this is certainly a project you should support.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. Deadline is March 1st. If you've tried before, maybe this year will be your year. Many artists apply multiple times before getting the grant. Use the grant to explore, honor elders and mentors, and contribute to the vibrancy of Alaska communities. The foundation offers workshops to help artists, makers, and culture bearers. More at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by Rasmussen.org, promoting a better life for all Alaskans.
The city of Fairbanks is getting ready to issue a request for proposals for the first phase of demolition of the condemned Polaris Hotel building. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, there's already interest in redeveloping the downtown site.
City of Fairbanks Mayor David Prus provided an update on the Polaris in an address to the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. Prus says the plan is to take down the derelict 11-story downtown high-rise in steps, starting with removal of a single-story annex connected to the main tower.
I would say within the next 30 days, we'll have the RFP, the first RFP, to knock down the annex building.
Prus says demo of the annex will be followed this summer by remediation and removal of asbestos, mold, and other contamination inside the main concrete tower.
Get that ready for the next round, which is just the concrete.
The concrete walls of the Polaris Tower are coated with paint containing PCBs, and that's elevated the estimated cost of tearing it down beyond $10 million the city has received from the EPA for the job. Additional funds will have to be secured, and it's unclear when the project will be completed. Meanwhile, there's already interest in redeveloping the site.
The pitch would be, you know, if you want a great place to work, eat, live, learn, and play for the rest of your life, this is certainly a project you should support.
Former Seattle Seahawks and San Francisco 49ers offensive tackle Gary Gilliam runs The Bridge, a Pennsylvania-based organization focused on mixed-use development to address common community problems.
Homeowner-occupied rates, education disparities, you know, being a food desert, becoming self-sufficient, not having to import things.
Gilliam says The Bridge aims to fix inequities and otherwise improve quality of life through what he calls eco-village development.
So offices and retail spaces, restaurants and farming, housing for low income, veterans, seniors, market rates, so housing for everyone. Our Learn Branch is an educational center teaching trades, teaching financial planning, financial wellness. And then our entertainment spaces, things like zip lines, adventure arcades.
Gilliam says The Bridge is developing the first eco-village in an old school in his hometown of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and is also scoping locations for other projects, including Fairbanks, where local activist Robert Shields contacted him about the Polaris property. Shields, who advocated in the past for turning the Polaris into a vertical farm, says he and Gilliam have similar development objectives.
Projects that are mixed use that not only provide financial revenue, but also social and environmental revenue as well.
How that's manifested at the Polaris site has not been nailed down, but Shields lists possibilities, including senior housing, a gym, daycare, office space, and even bringing back a bar and restaurant that once operated in the Polaris.
Reignite the torches on the Tiki Lounge. Kind of bringing that piece of history back into the future with us.
Shield says former Fairbanks resident and city council member Mark Hewitt, who's now chairman of NewGen Development, has joined to help finance the $200 million project. Hewitt declined to be interviewed, but he and Gilliam sent a letter of interest to Shields earlier this month.
Getting a letter of intent like this or a letter of interest is a huge step forward, but at the same time, it's not a check.
Shields recently read the letter at Fairbanks City Council and North Star Borough Assembly meetings. City Mayor Prus would not comment, stressing that all interested parties will eventually have an opportunity to submit proposals for redevelopment of the Polaris property.
Once we knock it down, we put out an RFP for people who want to acquire the property, and it'll be before the City Council, whatever their plan is, will be before the City Council for their approval. and we'll see what they have. Can't wait. But we're starting to get interest, and so we're excited about that. We encourage that.
If the Bridge Eco-Village project advances, Shields and Gilliam emphasize community input will shape redevelopment at the Polaris site. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The city of Soldotna has started reviewing the policies for its park following an outcry over a Pride Month performance in Soldotna Creek Park last summer. KDLL Sabine Pooks has more.
Soldotna City Manager Stephanie Queen says it's important not to put in place policies that would create arbitrary or legally indefensible rules. But at a meeting with the city's 7-member Parks and Recreation Advisory Board earlier this month, she said some clarification on city policies would be good.
We are restarting the conversation, so this will be the first of a few meetings, both at this board level and then ultimately at the city council, where these will be discussed, considered, and some solutions put in place. So thank you for engaging with us.
The review comes 6 months after the city took heat online and through hours of testimony over a drag performance in Soldotna Creek Park during Pride Month. Critics said the dancing was lewd and inappropriate for the public space, while others and representatives from the city said the performer's right to expression was protected under the law and in city code. But the city agreed to take another look at its decade-old reservation policies, as well as changes to city code that would clarify those rights and what counts as inappropriate. At the advisory board meeting, Queen and Parks and Rec Director Andrew Carmichael outlined a few recommended changes to code they hoped would address some of the concerns brought up at previous meetings. One recommendation was to add specific standards into city code that outline when park permits should be issued. For example, Queen recommended adding in a standard that says a permit should be issued when not doing so would violate an applicant's constitutional rights. Another proposed standard would say a permit can be issued when the activity won't include disorderly or obscene content, which she noted would also require expanded definitions of those words in municipal code.
We actually need to go through and describe in very clear terms what that means.
She says that would require parsing through in detail what parts of the body and what kinds of content would be considered offensive. The city also recommended removing the standard that says it should issue a permit when the proposed activity will not, quote, unreasonably interfere with or detract from the general public enjoyment of the park, end quote. That was a standard evoked repeatedly at city council meetings last summer.
That is a very vague standard that's not been defined. And we as staff should not be in a position of inserting our own judgment to something of this magnitude.
And the city also recommended adding a lewdness ordinance that would apply to public spaces citywide, not just to parks. And it outlined some administrative policies that would make it easier for people to avoid events that make them uncomfortable. Carmichael says they're working on an improved reservation policy and event calendar that would include more information about what's coming up at the park. He also recommended no event days that wouldn't have any scheduled events at the park at all. The advisory board didn't take actions on the recommendations. Queen says they'll meet again January 24th, where they could consider the recommendations as action items and take public comment. She says any changes would go before the Soldotna City Council for approval, with additional chances for public comment. You can read the recommended park policies at soldotna.org. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Alaska Pacific University offers an education as an adventure in living and learning. Students are the core of APU, representing the aspirations and collective wisdom of our community. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Alaska's Indigenous heritage while offering a unique and powerful educational experience. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Homer Drawdown is having its first meeting of 2023 today at the Kachemak Bay campus. The organization is part of a national grassroots movement that's working to address the impacts of climate change on a local level. After a series of community discussions last year, Drawdown is now working with the city of Homer on a number of projects to increase people-powered transportation and trail access around town. KBBI's Sean McDermott reports.
Homer Drawdown is working to make the community a safer and more enjoyable place to explore by bike and on foot. This past summer and fall, for instance, volunteers started clearing brush to connect existing trails downtown. Jan Kaiser is Homer's Public Works Director and the city engineer, and she says even though there has been a non-motorized transportation plan on the books in Homer for nearly 2 decades, progress has at times been slow.
But now there's massive interest as people are seeing opportunities for both health, recreation, ease of access. So that's been very interesting to see that change in culture in the community over time.
Kaiser says with growing support for pedestrian infrastructure, new plans are taking shape. The city is focusing on projects that can have an immediate impact from 1 year to the next. New sidewalks along Ben Walters and up to the Senior Citizen Center are two priorities. Along with Homer Drawdown, other community organizations, like Homer Trails Alliance, are working outside of the downtown area to make it easier to step onto a trail. Kaiser says the city is excited to be collaborating with these groups to connect and maintain existing trails and to create new ones.
We really appreciate and do not take for granted the help that these organizations bring to us.
Julie Engebretson is Homer's Economic Development Manager and has worked with the city for 20 years. She says whether you want to get your hands dirty or share a public comment during the planning process, community involvement is crucial.
We have great ideas and great involved citizenry and great planning documents, but we've had a harder time actually executing those plans and getting the trails constructed.
Expense is one problem, but there are other hurdles too. Engebretson says high turnover at Alaska's Department of Transportation has made it more difficult to build relationships to support long-term projects. And trying to adapt existing roads to add things like bike lanes can get complicated quickly, too. Still, some solutions are more straightforward. Discussions with commercial truckers, pedestrians, and cyclists last fall, for example, all called for a more visible way for people to cross Pioneer Avenue. Engebretson hopes that with state DOT approval and funding, the city will be able to install a crosswalk with a flashing light at the intersection of Pioneer and Svedland.
So we have more common goals across our community than maybe we realized before we started this project.
Dale Banks, owner of Loopy Lupin Distribution and an organizer with Homer Drawdown, says educational outreach can also help make the city safer and more accessible. For example, bicyclists often have to venture outside of designated bike lanes, so Drawdown is working to help drivers and cyclists learn how to share the road. One big win for bikers that Drawdown is working toward is a new park and bike lot on the East End bike path, which would enable people to leave their cars at McClay Road and cycle into town. Banks says these are just a few of the ways that Drawdown is working to chip away at carbon emissions.
These projects, although they are ostensibly designed to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere, they're really community projects that will make this place a better place to live for everybody.
Satchel Pandolfino, who is the lower inlet organizer with Cook Inlet Keeper and a Drawdown committee member, says coming to the first monthly meeting of the year is a great way to get involved.
Yeah, we really just want to empower anyone who's particularly passionate about any non-motorized transportation project to get connected with other people who are also excited about that project.
Pandolfino says she's excited that many of the longer-term infrastructure ideas that Drawdown volunteers are working on align so well with the city's goals. Homer is currently revamping its master transportation plan, which is expected to be available for public comment in March.
A lot of the projects that we talk about are more long-term, but they're like getting on the to-do list, which is really exciting.
Working with Drawdown to make Homer a more enjoyable place to walk and bike is a way to build a more vibrant and healthy community, as well as reducing carbon emissions, she adds.
Definitely been a source of hope and connection when the last few years have been kind of dark and isolating.
Reporting in Homer, I'm Sean McDermott.
Skagway's largest tour company and only railroad plans to return to Canada this year for the first time since 2019. KHNS's Mike Swayze reports on what that means for people in Skagway and Canada's Yukon Territory.
White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad will resume service to Fraser, BC and Carcross, Yukon this summer after 3 years of pandemic-related shutdowns. The railroad is Skagway's largest employer with about 170 workers. White Pass executive Tyler Rose says they have a lot of infrastructure work to finish before the season starts, but that it should be completed in time.
We're very pleased. I mean, obviously coming off 2022 and 2021 and before that, things look very positive right now.
The official schedule shows one-way passenger service to Fraser, BC will run daily from early May through early October, with continuing or return service being fulfilled by bus companies. Service to Carcross and Bennett in Canada's Yukon Territory will begin at the end of May and wrap up in mid-September. Carcross-based business owner Bonnie O'Connor, who runs Matthew Watson General Store along with her husband, says they are excited to see the increase in visitor traffic.
I think we all enjoy seeing that train rumble into town every day. You know, when you hear the whistle up the lake, you'll see people rush out to the street, buy popcorn, sit on a bench, watch it come in. It's a nice moment that we all share. So yes, from a business standpoint, it's great for us and great for all of the businesses in Carcross.
O'Connor says her business met its goals for last year, but it was still only a third of what they saw in 2019. She says finding employees this summer is going to be extra difficult.
Staffing is one of the biggest hurdles for all of us, every business in town. It just gets wrapped up in a whole load of lack of available housing, the price of gas. For people who might have considered commuting from Whitehorse out to work in Carcross, it's unthinkable the way things are now.
Skagway Mayor Andrew Cremata says White Pass returning to Canada will also be good for his community.
Being able to take thousands of people over the border into Canada on the train is going to alleviate a lot of the congestion here in town. I also think it's wonderful for people living in Carcross and for people living in the Yukon. It's going to be a big boost to their economy.
Cremata says he expects a return to pre-pandemic cruise ship visitor numbers, or possibly even more this summer. The railroad will offer a combination train and bus service to Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, from the end of May through the middle of September. They also plan to offer daily round-trip summit tours all summer while cruise ships are in port. It is still unclear when they will offer Chilkoot Trail return trips, as the trail remains closed due to extensive flooding last fall. Reporting from Skagway, I'm Mike Swayze.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint in Anchorage, Kavitha George in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Sean McDermott in Homer, and Mike Swayze in Skagway. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline since 1977, from Prudhoe Bay to the Port of Valdez.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.